Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do for 5 years now. Isn't that something? Breaking news, by the way. If you're going to be at Toronto Comic Con later this month, and if Toronto Comic Con isn't shut down by virus panic, come by and catch our very first live episode, Sunday, March 22nd at 2 p.m. in the Podcast Theater, room 802B. I will be doing a simcast with... I'm pretty sure you're going to like the guest. My guest this week is Marie Clements, a writer, director, and producer whose credits include the feature documentary The Road Forward and the shorter work Looking at Edward Curtis. Her first dramatic feature, Red Snow, follows the emotional journey of a Gwich'in Canadian soldier trying to survive after he's taken hostage by the Taliban in Afghanistan. It opens in Toronto, Vancouver, and Ottawa this Friday, March 13th. And we were both in the UK last month, so somehow this very Canadian episode was recorded high over London. Marie picked Crash, Paul Haggis's Oscar-winning 2004 drama about a dozen or so people in Los Angeles whose lives are entangled by race, privilege, circumstance, and traffic. Boasting a killer ensemble cast for a smallish indie, it premiered at TIFF in the fall of 2004, opened theatrically in the spring of 2005, and 1 year later went to the Oscars with 6 major nominations, winning Best Picture, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Film Editing. It was a dark horse contender then, and it's kind of been an underdog winner ever since. Although, to be honest, I think it's pretty decent. So does Marie. This is Someone Else's Movie.
Why this Crash? I was thinking about that when I was asked. We're going through the kind of the file card of all the films that you've ever seen that impacted you.
Sure.
But I think it still remains one of those films where... I wasn't ready for it. I think I wanted to see something like Crash, but I wasn't really ready for it. And there's a couple scenes that I'll never forget in the film itself. So those are the things that stayed with me, even though the film came out in 2004. Mm-hmm. I can still reference those two scenes that I kind of went, wow, that's so disturbing and human and terrible and extraordinary.
Well, okay, let's get right to it. What are the scenes?
What are they?
I can think of a couple that stood out that strongly, but I don't want to indicate anything.
Well, it's probably the same ones, right?
Yeah.
But it was with the cop and obviously the couple coming back from the awards show.
Right.
And those two encounters, the first one, of course, when the cop humiliates her in front of her husband, was really, I wasn't expecting that for the first time viewing. And then, of course, the scene where that same cop pulls her out of the car and her reaction to seeing him. And this intimate moment where there's a switch where he saves her, and there's something in that moment where I think he also saves himself.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is, I mean, everyone remembers, you know, Matt Dillon was the Oscar nominee of the entire cast. He was the only actor to be nominated. And those two scenes are why, clearly, right? I mean, they demonstrate incredible range. But also, he has Tandy Newton as his scene partner, and she's amazing. She has to carry all that with her for the entire film, and play the extreme emotions in both cases, humiliation and panic and terror and, you know, just completely breaking down for different reasons both times, really, throughout
the
film.
I think it was just so nuanced on the idea that I think her betrayal of that character, just she's such a obviously a beautiful woman in this character, but just the rage that is inside of that she has to live with from this incident, and even it kind of the with her husband witnessing too was almost worse. It was almost because now they had this secret between them that revealed things that could end a relationship very easily.
Yeah, and I've been wrestling with this because Crash has become the I'm trying to think of what the term is. It's become the easy target for the well-meaning Oscar nominations and awards because it won Best Picture, mm-hmm. because it is a film ostensibly about empathy and humanity. And these are things that people are very uncomfortable with. And because Paul Haggis is sort of a schematic writer and a much more emotional director, it seems to reveal his mechanisms right? You can see the bones of the film in the script. You can see the script's bones a lot easier than some other films. I think since Green Book came out, Crash has gotten a bit better understanding. I like it. I never understood why. I mean, I do. I understand cynicism, right? Why people were just sort of crapping on it almost immediately. But we were talking about this before mm-hmm. we started recording. I was on the jury at TIFF in 2004 that we were watching all the Discovery entries, and this was one of them. And mm-hmm. Crash was, it was a contender for our prize, for Presci Prize. And this is the world premiere. It was a year and a half before the Oscars. They didn't even have, it wasn't ready for us to see in advance. We actually had to, it was one of the handful of movies that we saw at the world premiere because the print was wet. They brought it in fresh. Mm-hmm. And they trotted out all the stars, and it was this big deal. And like, oh, Sandra Bullock will be there. We have to get you in early ahead of security. And come on. Mm-hmm. But it was, it is a little, not tortured, but it is a little obvious in the way that it lines everything up and the way that it brings everything together. But I still think that the underlying message is something that is really sincere. And I think he is, Paul Haggis as I don't want to sound like I'm insulting him, but a well-secluded, like he is the gated community guy. In the film, effectively, he's the one who exists apart from all of these things and looks down and says, oh, that's bad, I should write a movie about it. But he's done it. He's made the movie, and he's trying to make this statement. And, you know, to watch everyone just sort of discard it because it was a small film with a lot of big stars and actors who signed on because they believed in something. And the drama is a little obvious, but it's allegorical and archetypal. I think you... I don't know how you make a movie like this that is subtle. I don't know that you can, right? Like, Soderbergh could probably do it, but it would be a different film.
Yeah, I mean, all the narrative threads, you know, obviously were constructed to collide and realign themselves in time, which is what I found as a writer exciting, to figure out, you know, why he, you know, not only you experience the film and then you're going back and going, oh, was that too obvious, or could have that, you know, been strung differently? But I did appreciate the effect of it, and I think that's something that is possibly like the form of it had the effect to emotionally shift something as you watched it. So I think there's something in that form that I love, whether it was perfect or not, or to me perhaps too obvious. And I was reading back on it, and I think he said when he won, you know, the biggest awards for it, he said he himself did not think it was the best film of that year, but he did believe that it was the film that touched people probably the most.
Yeah.
And I thought that's kind of extraordinary, because I know there's, you know, obviously there's... you know, just so many beautiful filmmakers and ways to approach things, but there's something about the content, the themes, something that's current, something that's human, that kind of allows us to be affected emotionally, which is really not a dirty word. It's actually, you know, why we go see films. We want to be pushed and to feel. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, and I think maybe I wonder if maybe some of us are uncomfortable with watching people in that level of sort of melodramatic pain up close. I mean, the poster was Matt Dillon cradling a wailing Tandy Newton, and that just says, like, this is the kind of emotional hit you're going to have, and maybe the Academy responded to that en masse because they all watched it at home. That was a big part of it. Lionsgate sent out DVDs an unprecedented For Your Consideration push at the time because it was a small film that wouldn't have been noticed. And maybe you can just relate to that privately more easily than you can in an audience. Certainly the crowd I saw with, it was the Elgin, I think, so it would have been, it was a big room and people were into it. I mean, TIFF audiences are notoriously supportive and they applauded a lot. But it felt like people were behind it. It felt like people understood what it was trying to do.
Well, I think it made us, made some of us, I mean, those of us that are culturally diverse and live in cities and with histories that have always been culturally coming at all sides, and we're having to deal with it every day in our own prejudices and uncomfortable about racism. I think that
it's just the wind.
It's just the wind. Oh no, we fell off the building. I think, you know, for those of us that had to deal with racism or deal with these topics, I think that was kind of a relief to see, even if, it was such a mixed cast and it was such a very different perspectives of how we look at each other and how we don't. And I think that was refreshing. Like, it just kind of went, okay, you know, this film recognizes that we're all in the world together, good or bad, and dealing with each other.
Yeah, it's a white middle-aged man, a white middle-aged Scientologist at the time.
Oh, what?
Making this film. Yeah, Haggis very famously fled the church, or if it's a church at all, to the point where I've met him a few times around TIFF, but not enough that, you know, he would recognize me. And I ran into him in New York 3 or 4 years ago around Thanksgiving, and just said hi, and he reacted just like he was scared that someone had recognized him. And apparently this is a state he exists in, that he's worried about reprisals. He's spoken about it leaving the Church of Scientology. Okay. And I had to apologize, and he's like, no, I'm Canadian, it's okay, everything's fine,
I'm nice, I'll talk to you.
Yeah, exactly. And he was still a little nervous even after I told him who I was and where we'd met before. And I guess, I mean, I assume celebrities have this anyway, this built-in nervousness, but I have never bumped into anyone that I vaguely recognize and had them be scared to be named. Okay. I just said, hey, Paul, how are you? And he's like,
who are you? Yeah. Where are you coming from?
Yeah.
It was, oh, that's something. Yeah. Okay.
But for him to make this movie and to, I guess in 2004, it was probably, well, it's never been hard for a white filmmaker to make a movie like this, but in 2004 it was probably simpler to just get people on board, right? You don't have to.
Well, it doesn't seem that far away, 2004, but then when you really look at the numbers, you go, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That was over 15 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of extraordinary, and I do think that times were, you know, different in a sense, because I think things have shifted around those topics and around those politics and cultural politics and politics and film and artists and who gets to say what and all those things, which is exciting. But I guess it really has shifted, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the time it was perceived as brave and bold that anyone could make a movie that simply says, hey, racism is bad and we should all just sort of listen to each other.
Right.
And maybe there is some element, I mean, certainly, I think the subplot with Michael Peña would be, it's the one thing I don't think holds up at all, just because of the, you know what it is, it's the screenwriter's gimmick of the switch with the bullets.
Right.
It just...
you were like...
Well, because when it happens in the movie, it is this huge build-up, and it's this big... It's the one crescendo that he doesn't really earn as a filmmaker, that Haggis sort of... Because he knows it's the, you know, William Goldman's story about Butch and Sundance and how the big jump, the super posse sequence he wrote about it at length in Adventures in Screen Trade. He's like, I know that Sundance can't swim. And that's, the whole scene is building towards that. And it's going to be such a brilliant moment. It's like, well, it is great.
Yes.
But it's not the point of the scene. It's a joke that lands.
Right.
And here it's the same thing. It's the whole movie in Haggis's mind seems to be based on this huge reversal. And it's all because we, the audience, have made the assumption that the bullets are real. But the movie's actively tricking us.
Yeah.
And then it goes on for that sequence, that moment goes on for so long that you can feel the film sort of straining to sell it.
Yeah.
And it's also because we assume that, you know, all Latino characters are bad and sinister and calculating. That's where the film's state of mind is, even though the film doesn't want it to be.
Yeah.
It's this unconscious bias.
It's very set up with, you know, the politician's wife and that whole scenario about, you know, changing the locks and her kind of breakdown too. So there's moments where I go, I'm not necessarily in the buy-in, but I think sometimes, I guess people are pushing, you know, writers are pushing to connect things that might necessarily don't have to be that clean.
Yeah.
Right. So I guess it's easier for us to look back and go, hey, wait a minute, why didn't you do this?
Yeah.
Or why are these moments, you know?
I also remember a throwaway line somewhere in the middle about the bullets. Oh, it's the scene where they're buying the blanks,
yes,
where somebody says, do you want those? You sure?
Yeah.
And then I just thought, oh, okay, that's links and pipe. That's something that will come back.
Right.
And of course it did.
Yes.
But it's that weird thing where Haggis's earnestness and his co-writer, Bobby Moresco, they're both working towards something, and I think they feel like their endgame justifies whatever else is necessary. So the brutality of mm-hmm. Dylan's character, in his racism, in his misogyny, in his mistreatment of everyone around him in that scene, is justified by the fact that he is a good person underneath, or that he's capable of being a good person. And that binary, right? The black-white thing, and not in terms of race, but in terms of morality, that's what the movie wants to play with. And ultimately, I keep wanting to say forgive him, because that's the music, that's the tone.
Yeah, right.
But it's not redemptive exactly, right? Because he's still that person.
Yeah, I don't think it's redemptive. I think it's because, I think what he was trying to say is that it's not totally redemptive, but it is human.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even as a witness to the drama, you're going, well, I can't hate Matt. I really want to hate his character. But then he's seeing how beautiful he is with his father, and you're like, oh God, why can't you just be a total asshole? But you're not, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I think that's a lot like real events and, you know, people we meet that are not just one thing.
Yeah.
And that gets complicated in our brains. Yeah.
And it's what movies are not supposed to want to do, right? Because we think we're going for clarity.
Yeah.
And especially at that time, before, I mean, empathy filmmaking, it's always been there. Roger Ebert's line about the empathy machine and how cinema is the thing that lets us see other people's lives. There was a point where, I mean, I find it absolutely fascinating that so many people hate Crash because it won Best Picture the year that Brokeback Mountain was out.
Right.
Which is unfair. It's not, you know, deserves got nothing to do with it. It's never about that. It's always just a choice that the Academy makes as an entity.
Right.
Of you know, at the time it would have been like 5,500 completely, not diverse really, but completely unrelated people.
Yeah, not diverse,
way
really.
Way more diverse now. But Brokeback Mountain is a film about the same thing. Like, it's about living somebody else's perspective and understanding. It's about sexuality and gender rather than about prejudice and racism, although it is still about prejudice. And I mean, I don't think in the rearview mirror, I don't think there's any question that one film is superior to the other, but they're both trying to do something for an audience that doesn't necessarily want to see that level of complexity portrayed in the characters that they're being presented with.
I think we do want to see it, right? I mean, I think there's a whole bunch of people that don't, and probably that's why a lot of other movies don't get made.
Yeah.
But I do think that diverse people want to see diverse people on screen in real life situations. Every other movement, you know, whether it be a gay rights movement, lesbian rights, like, people want to see their stories because it's, you know, part of the human condition, and why can't we see more?
Yeah.
But I think it was a bit of, maybe it was the timing of 2004 when both these films were in the running, and, you know, both really extraordinary in very different ways, and probably not perfect in other ways for all peoples.
Right. Well,
but
that's what I mean.
You know, but the stakes are high when you actually see, you know, a movie of, you probably, you know, gay rights for a lot of people. Like, you kind of see that movie has to be everything, and yet it can only be one filmmaker's, you know, vision of the world.
Well, and especially in the case of Brokeback, where it really is only a handful of people. It's a small cast. It's the first hour is just the two of them.
Right.
It's, I guess what I'm not sure I'm articulating it properly. I think the challenge is that they're, well, Brokeback is a studio film. Like, it's coming out of Focus and Universal. And so, you know, Ung Lee is wrestling with the demands of a mainstream audience, the expectations of a mainstream audience. And so he pulls back, I think, on a lot of the sexuality. Right. And it's, I mean, it's there in the actors' performances, but it's not a, it's nowhere near as confrontational, not even graphic, but just honest about mechanics and about everything. A lot of stuff is out of frame. We don't see things, and we don't see a lot of physicality, because I think the presumption is that audiences were ready for it.
Yeah.
And with Crash, it felt like Haggis is turning up the ugliness because he wants to confront audiences with it, but he can because it's all just dialogue, right? Like, it's
it's
a thing you can do.
Yes.
And so Crash gets mistaken for the more honest depiction of the thing.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to go for. Sorry, I'm putting it together. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. The fact that Crash has, I mean, it has black characters dealing with white racism between themselves.
Like
that's the thing we hadn't seen before in a frame like that.
Yeah.
It has Latin characters interacting, privileged white characters in a way that shows us that the white characters are the bad guys, right? Like the casual racism, the assumptions, the presumptions.
Right.
And the dignity is on the other side. The dignity is given to the characters who are just being forced to suffer through all of this, which is bullshit, right? I mean, in any kind of power base or any kind of real situation, but for the purposes of the drama, Haggis has to make us sit in it.
Yes.
And I always wondered about that from the perspective of a Latin audience.
Right.
How would they feel about that? I mean, they get it, but it's still, you're watching the beatdown, you're not watching the triumph.
Yeah, well, I guess that's a complication of dealing with so many storylines, so many kind of issue-based storylines within one structure, and wrapping it up, you know, because I do think that the structure really, part of it is if it's constructed to have collisions and kind of an overall, you know, effect of just being, you know, in a slammed up in front of another person, and it's not that great.
Right. Yeah, that's
right. It's not that great. But I thought maybe, you know, when the politician's wife, when she falls down the stairs and, you know, the Latino maid is the only friend she has, you know, there's things like that. I go, oh, okay, well, I don't know. But I think it was, maybe you're right, that things were tied up a little too well. But I guess that's part of the structure of it, right? Because I don't know, like, obviously that's probably not real, is it? But these relationships that people take advantage of, and they have, you know, they have more status in those relationships, and they think they own the world, and yet they're being looked after by people that help them live in a world that keeps that status up.
Yeah.
So that was interesting for me. I don't know, you know, if it was entirely successful, but I think it was trying to get at all these second decisions we make in life, walking down the street and we're passing by each other and we just saw each other, you know, this way or that way, but we don't know what each other's going through. We don't know how we're going to impact each other, if we are at all. So that was what fascinated me about it. Like, even in the filmmaking, you know, every other, you know, when we're intersecting from one storyline to another, you know, someone's passing by that you saw on the scene, you know, five scenes down, and this guy's driving by and this woman's, you know, so I don't know why I loved all that stuff, that it was this kind of big ensemble, you know, not a play, but it was just an ensemble performance where perhaps we're more connected than we think we are.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's not a gimmick exactly, but it is a narrative device where you're right. It would work on a play because it would work on stage because we would only have a handful of actors and we would only see the same people over and over again. It's the trick. I'm always waiting. I don't know why it's perverse on my part, but I'm always waiting for the pullout to find out it's some sort of space zoo where the only people here are these people we've been watching, because that would explain why they keep running into each other. But that's silly. I acknowledge that. That's just me.
That's okay. You can give him those notes. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, exactly.
Next time you see him.
Did you think about a space zoo?
Did you think about doing this?
That would make sense of a lot of other movies, actually. But it was in vogue very much at the time, right?
Yeah.
So it was it was something Miramax pioneered because they keep casting the same seven or eight actors in, in movie after movie after movie. And it spread through independent cinema. And it actually gave us a lot of Soderbergh's pictures, which are great because he uses mass casts to look at a subject, at an institution or a cultural, social thing. And I think Haggis and Maresco's script does the same thing.
Right.
It is very... it's interdependent.
Yes.
On relationships.
Yeah.
But it's also, you're right. There's definitely an insistence on making sure we don't see one person as any one thing exclusively. And we get to see people from other people's perspectives. We see characters are revisited from other perspectives in moments that make us recontextualize our opinions of them.
Yeah, which I like, because I think it's hard to go, especially dealing with topics of like racism and prejudice, it's hard to really go, oh, any one person is any one thing. Mm-hmm. And it's good to remember that it's usually a lot more complicated, good or bad.
Yeah.
But maybe that's what I appreciated too, because I think it's really complicated. And LA is a really complicated history. And is still a complicated city in regards to how that plays out. So I appreciated that it really represented, you know, the land. It represented a kind of historical contact that was never quite comfortable.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's a desert community, effectively, right?
There was no indigenous people in it. That's the only thing.
I was going to say, it's literally settled land, and the film doesn't really deal with that.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's because Haggis just doesn't encounter them, or because they were all, like, literally driven out long before he ever got there.
Well, he probably doesn't recognize them. I mean, it's the highest population of indigenous urban...
Los Angeles.
Urban peoples in.
Still.
Yeah.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. But, yeah, okay, so then it is.
But maybe he just didn't, you know, recognize that, which happens in America quite a bit.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Wow. What was your first experience of the film? Did you see it theatrically? Did you catch it later?
Yeah, no, I think I did see it in theaters. And I think, you know, that, we love I think we still need to see, films in theaters, but, you know, we consume so much. I think, like everybody else, we're just consuming stories, after work, just kind of going, oh, I'm going to binge on this, but it's still lovely to sit in a theater, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
It's something that I'm lucky enough that I still get to do it fairly often, but I know that the experience is disappearing for a lot of people.
Right.
I was talking to somebody back in Toronto last week who said that going to see Parasite was the first one they'd seen in the theater in a year.
Wow.
And it was it was before the Oscar win, but it was because of the buzz.
Yeah.
And he said, we went out, we made the trip. And I'm like, oh my God, you've only seen one movie in a theater all year? How are you alive?
Well,
I get it. TV sets are bigger at home.
But we have bigger TVs and we have great sound systems now. So I guess that's what we're doing, right?
No.
We're staying inside. bad.
You have to go out.
Get outside.
Maybe this will be the start of the crash, the renaissance, the rediscovery of Crash, and people can see it. Because I think you do need to see it with a crowd. Although now I worry that people will, watch it ironically and hiss or hoot or do dumb stuff. Because people do that and it's annoying anyway. Okay. The only thing you can do that with is cats.
Okay.
Legally.
Yeah, that was...
By law.
I haven't seen Cats.
I saw it in the theater.
Did you? Okay, you
terrible.
Did. You got the full experience.
Yeah, I don't recommend that. There are films that absolutely benefit from being seen with an audience, especially something like this where you have the potential to hear people responding differently, different scenes landing with different crowds. Yeah, why wouldn't you want to do that? Why wouldn't people want to go see a movie in a theater?
Well, I think we're busy. There's one thing, but I know, as a filmmaker, even you're watching your film over and over again, and what's always fascinating is what people respond to or what they don't, and watching people. So that's the weird, you're a little bit of a, you're not a stalker, but you're sitting there, you're not necessarily always watching every scene of your film, you're watching people watch your film.
Yeah,
oh, which is sad.
It's got to be a voyeuristic experience.
But their responses too are different, right? Mm-hmm. In different places, so that's kind of fun.
Yeah, and yeah. To that end, I mean, there's definitely a running theme in Red Snow about people perceiving what they want to perceive, seeing other people as they want to see them. And when you brought up Crash, I thought, oh, right, there is that.
Right.
That entire arc in your film. Yeah. Without giving any spoilers away about people. I'm just trying to figure out how to talk about it. Well, I mean, both of the principal characters are loyal to more than one thing.
Yes.
Or divided in their loyalties. And... yeah, how do you build something like that as a writer? How do you structure that? Was Crash in your mind when you were working on it, or was it just...
Well, certainly, I do believe contact sometimes is like a collision. So it's really looking at what happens when two, you know, different peoples from extremely different backgrounds come face-to-face with each other. So on the face of it, you go, well, these are two ancient indigenous cultures that have survived many wars,
yeah.
But we have very different systems of belief, and a lot of things that connect, you know, because of still being connected to the land and still being connected to the identity of what that gives you. Mm-hmm. So those were kind of the launch-in points. Yes.
And so you write them into conflict.
Well, yeah, I think we can be, we're conflicted with each other a lot, but I think it's always when we have to survive things that are bigger than our smallness, we tend to rise up to that as human beings, and we tend to have to rise up to that together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how are audiences responding to it? Now that you've seen the film with audiences, are they getting what you're trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't, I also wrote Red Snow, so a lot of times you go, well, I get it. No, just kidding. And there's a whole bunch of people that worked with me that got it. But what is it? How is it really going to land?
But when you put it in front of an audience that doesn't have the background that you've brought to it.
But I was really pleasantly surprised.
Good,
right?
Good.
Because again, the structure is a little bit out there for some peoples. Mm. But certainly, I think what we got to is that people were able to feel connected to it. And they were emotional about it, and they were surprised to see what would happen, because it's not necessarily, you're not going, you're not really knowing where you're going to get to. So
yeah.
That was kind of fun to see how that sat with them, or where it sat with them.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it alone again.
Okay. Not in a theater?
No, it was sadly not an option. But I would be curious to see how it plays with a room.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always curious.
Yeah.
I like the idea that there are, 400 people in a space all having different experiences of the same thing. And I mean, watching Crash was absolutely that too. Okay. And TIFF, it was, again, you're in a room with everybody,
right.
And because it's a film festival, everyone came up and there was a big introduction, and then there was everyone taking bows afterwards, and it was kind of a major love fest,
right.
Almost to an obnoxious point, because it is a world premiere and it's all that.
Yeah.
But it's a it's an experience of a film that you only get to have once, because the second time through you're watching a movie you've already seen, and it changes the dynamic,
right.
Your expectations are different, and you're paying more attention to the audience this time because you want to know if people agree with you on your take.
Right.
And the experience of it was, I'm watching somebody try. I'm watching somebody put his, for all the complaints leveled against its earnestness and mm-hmm. What's the word I'm looking for? It's not... I mean, I suppose intensity, the way that it just hammers certain points.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what happens when somebody cares and wants to make sure you get the message, right?
Yeah.
Like, it is a message movie.
Yes.
It crashes in a really traditional Stanley Kramer kind of way.
Right.
And you can reduce it to hey, can't we all just get along, and the most basic. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of that's an insulting compression.
Right.
I think I really like movies that try to do something, and I respect the effort, even if it is a little bit overly demonstrative in its emotionality, I suppose. And now I'm just sounding like I'm trying to hand wave away its problems, but those problems are part of its effect.
Yeah, I don't think movies have to be perfect. You know, I mean, I think most filmmakers will, obviously the pursuit is to make a perfect movie.
Sure.
You know, the execution, all the things we love to talk about, of course. But really, the perfection really is, I think it can land differently, you know. It's so, for all the critiques of films, you kind of go, well, it was done in a perfect moment of time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was done with the perfect intention. And I think you'll go in and you'll see it again, revisit that movie, and you'll go, oh, that was a bit this or the, that. Oh, that could have, should, you know, could have, sure, should have, yeah, done. But I think there's something to the idea that maybe art doesn't necessarily have to be perfect to all people. That it has to be perfect in the moment, and it has to inform the next wave of what needs to be said.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to look at it. And certainly, I mean, even Crash, it took a year and a half to win Best Picture, right? It was, yeah, a TIFF in 2004. It didn't open until the spring of 2005. Oh. And then it took another almost full year, because it was late in March that the Academy Awards happened. Okay. It took a long time to be recognized. And when it happened, it was perceived as a dark horse and a big surprise that it won. And I think if it had been in the 2004 race, it probably wouldn't have won.
Right.
If it had been in the 2006 race, it wouldn't have won. It was right at that moment where it was the movie that people needed,
right,
or the Academy needed to,
yeah,
embrace.
Because I think, and I could be wrong, I looked it up again because it had been a while since I've seen it, like we all do.
Sure.
And I think it's Netflix's one of highest hits still. And that's, you know...
That makes a kind of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I go, why would it be, you know, because there's some, you know, we're watching so much, but I was like, that's curious to me too. Like,
but that cast too, right? Like,
oh, wow.
You see Michael Peña and you want to go see more of his stuff, and this,
yeah,
comes up, or Matt Dillon, yeah, or Sandra Bullock, or...
They're a pretty beautiful ensemble.
Yeah, right? It's pretty stacked.
Yeah.
And I'm forgetting someone else. I know I am. Terrence Howard?
Terrence Howard, hold on, I have one, yeah, more list, the guy that I'd love to, Don Cheadle,
of,
yeah,
course, Don Cheadle,
yeah,
who is just always, you know, like, always the best thing in any situation. And Jennifer Esposito, who played his partner.
That's, yeah.
Just a solid cast,
yeah, like,
straight on down,
yeah,
everybody in it is good.
They're all good, so
yeah,
it's just beautiful to watch them, if nothing, you know, you're just watching how they're, packing it in.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder if maybe that's it too. The message sort of overwhelms the idea that this really is an actor's movie. Like,
right,
it is about performances.
Yes. Well, they, as you were saying, you know, they didn't, there's a lot of dialogue, and a lot of it's very fast and cutting, and you have to be on top, you know, of that as an actor.
Yeah.
And it's building. It's not that, it's just you're having one scene, you're building to these crescendos, and so that cast had to be very, you know, on it.
Yeah, and for the people who are shouting, Brendan Fraser, yes, I forgot Brendan Fraser.
Oh, I'm sorry, forgot Brendan.
And he's a lovely guy.
He's a lovely guy. Yeah,
yeah,
he's good in it, too.
He is,
yeah,
right? Like,
yeah,
it's one of those things where the casting is,
yeah,
really smart. It's people who can play against our expectations or right into them.
Yeah.
And, you know, for all the talk of Sandra Bullock really pushing herself to play someone unlikable,
yeah,
it's in her wheelhouse. She's capable of that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, yeah, Fraser or Newton especially, I think, who'd never been seen with that kind of range,
okay,
or never been given an opportunity in American film to demonstrate that sort of range.
Yeah.
I'd been aware of her in her Australian work for years, but, you know, then she shows up in the second Mission Impossible and is just so misused by,
right,
that film that people would come away thinking, this woman they'd never seen before was just sort of okay.
She's all right.
Yeah.
No, she's extraordinary actor.
She really,
yeah,
is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dylan's, you know, as you said at the top of this, Dylan's a great scene partner for her, and he's pretty legitimately solid.
Yeah, I really love his, you know, his wheelhouse, what he's been doing. But yeah, I think the combinations too, like the surprising combinations too, really ignited those actors and the challenge of, you know, drama, right? Yeah. High stakes drama.
See what happens when these two forces are in the same space.
Yeah.
That's what movies are.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
My thanks to Marie Clements, whose new film Red Snow opens in Toronto, Vancouver, and Ottawa this Friday, March 13th. Thanks also to Jen Paris and Nicola Pender. They know what they did. Marie's not on Twitter, but you can follow her movie at Red Snow Film, all one word, and you can find Crash on Blu-ray and DVD from E1 in Canada and Lionsgate Home Entertainment in the US. It's also streaming on Crave in Canada and Netflix in the US, and it's available for rental and purchase on iTunes. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. And if you're at Toronto Comic Con on Sunday, March 22nd, catch our first live episode, 2 p.m., podcast stage, room 802B. It's going to be fun. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it or the show in general, say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. They're pretty good. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. See you next week.